good evening, and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. The lack of affordable housing across the state is the focus of at least three different propositions on this November's ballot. Propositions 1 and 2 are bond measures to make affordable housing more available, while Proposition 10, our focus tonight, would repeal a state law that limits cities' abilities to impose rent control. That law, the 1995 Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act, strictly limited local rent control laws. Under the legislation, local laws cannot apply to housing built after 1995, single-family homes, condos, and therefore, this is what we're talking about tonight. Should these restrictions be repealed. Prop 10 would repeal Costa-Hawkins and would remove these legal requirements, therefore allowing cities to decide whether they want to adopt rent control or decide to make changes to existing rent control laws. Advocates of Prop 10 are rallying around the slogan that the rent is too damn high and argue that something needs to be done to make housing more affordable in the short term. Those who oppose Prop 10 point out that economists on the left and right all agree that rent control is a policy that limits and not increases affordable housing. As of early October, over $62 million has been poured into the Prop 10 campaign from both sides. Advocates are passionate about the cause on both sides. And so we asked tonight, what's the right solution for the problem of affordable housing and the ever-rising cost of living in California? Is it the passage of Prop 10 or not? Joining us in the studio tonight to discuss these issues and more are Deepa Varma, the executive director of the San Francisco Tenants Union and part of the Yes on Prop 10 Coalition. Welcome, Deepa.
Welcome, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
Also joining us here in the studio is Matt Regan, the senior vice president of Bay Area Council. He's in charge of their housing policy efforts, and the Bay Area Council is part of the No on 10 campaign. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And joining us by phone is Connor Doherty. He's a reporter with the New York Times who covers the West Coast economics and real estate. Welcome, Connor.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for letting me call in too. I live in the East Bay and I had to put my kid to bed.
So. No problem. Thanks for joining us. And, of course, we'll invite you, our listeners, in about 20 minutes to join our conversation. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can send your questions and comments at any time by emailing us at cityvisions@kalw.org. So, Connor Doherty, I wanted to start with you. To understand Prop 10, we need to understand a little bit more about the bill it's trying to repeal. I mentioned it earlier, Costa-Hawkins. Say a little bit more about how Costa-Hawkins came to be. And what does it do, and what's been its impact on California?
So, if the bill is repealed, nothing will happen on the first day. It gives cities an option to do basically broader and more restrictive forms of rent control. So, Costa-Hawkins is a bill that prevents cities from applying rent control to older units, which are, it's different in every place. In San Francisco, it's 79, but generally it's 95. And it also it creates something called vacancy decontrol, which is very confusing, but basically it means if you move out, the rent can go up as much as possible, or as much to the market rate when the person moves out. So that's why people hold on very tightly to a rent-controlled apartment, because the person after them, it's not really rent-controlled anymore. It just goes up to whatever the regular rate is.
But then does rent control kick back in once that the
rent of course.
Is, okay.
I didn't mean it like that. I just meant, as you know, there are apartments where one person's paying, $1,200, and their neighbor might pay $2,400 or whatever else, and that's because of even though they're both technically under rent control. So this can get very confusing very quickly, but I think the important thing to remember is that it would allow cities to apply rent control to more units and newer units, and it would allow cities more flexibility in how restrictive they would be with the rents.
So when you say more units, you mean those built after 1995 or potentially in San Francisco, those built after 79, and then single-family homes and condos would be fair game, so to speak?
Yes.
Which they're not currently.
So there you go.
Right. And then you mentioned that it would be up for negotiation with how landlords could or could not raise the rent once someone moved out. But your point is that nothing changes the day after the election should Prop 10 pass. It's then just leaves municipalities the option to be able to do things without the same with no longer having the same constraints that they've had to work under since Costa-Hawkins was passed.
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
And so,
anyway, yeah, no. So it would give cities a lot more flexibility. Now, of course, you might see. I'm not going to. You know, we could spend all night talking about different dominoes. It's possible people, if it passed, people would do things in anticipation of the law being changed and stuff like that. But legally speaking, nothing would change on the first day.
Right. So it's not. It's hard to predict, or can you predict what could happen if Prop 10 passed? If we don't quite, if there's many steps that have to fall after that,
I don't. I don't think that's predicting. Other than there would be a very lively conversation at the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and a couple other cities. I don't think I want to predict what would happen right away. Not just because I'm being a cop-out, but, you know, a lot of investors and other people will... People on both sides will posture about what they say they're going to do if something happens, and it's not entirely clear if they will really do that thing. So I don't think it's a good idea to get too deep into that, because sometimes you're playing into people's, you know... Playing into people who are trying to get you to vote one way or the other.
Got it. Okay, that's just a chance for to give our audience an understanding of what this is about, what happens if it passes immediately, and what could happen down the road. And at this point, one of the things we're going to talk about a lot over this hour is whether Costa-Hawkins has impacted the ability for more affordable housing to be built in California. Do you have any research you can point to that might point to that question, or what might happen if rent control were to become something that's become more widespread or less restricted?
So there's going to be a lot of discussion here and a lot of parsing of studies. And when you go, you know, and read about this online or wherever, you will always see a lot of dueling studies. Here's what I think is important to think about. Politics is about a choice. People have their choice now. And economics is about costs. And people can tally costs imperfectly, but they do probably the best job, you know, imperfectly. I think that when we're talking about this issue, it might well be that some people hear what people have to say about, you know, rent control and how it very much does help tenants today. And they'll say, you know what, that's a choice I want to make. But I think people should also be wary that there are costs, and it might well be that those costs are totally acceptable to them as a voter, and it might be that they're not. But the costs aren't free, and so I think that, you know, and you probably, you can make a very strong argument that people need rent control now, that we're in a crisis, that it needs to be expanded, and that the costs are worth it. Fair point that some people will probably make. And some people will say the costs aren't worth it, but I don't think you should listen to anyone who says there's no costs. The costs generally are that you're more or less, this is what the research shows, you're helping renters today, and it absolutely does help renters today, as anyone with rent control can tell you, at the expense of renters tomorrow. Clearly, people who move here more recently pay much higher rents than people who have been here for a while in a rent-controlled unit. There's lots of other stuff that we could get into, but I think that that's the choice. That is the large-scale, high-level conclusion that a lot of studies come to. And I think they pretty much match what most people experience on the ground. You don't have to be an economist to know that it's nice to get rent control, but you also don't have to be an economist to know that people who move here more recently or to New York or other places with rent control pay a lot more than people who've been in for a while.
All right. Well, with that introduction from Connor Doherty from the New York Times, who covers the West Coast, I want to turn to our guests in the studio, and we'll be coming back to you, Connor, as the hour unfolds, who are going to be making their arguments for and against Prop 10. So I want to reintroduce Deepa Varma. She's the executive director of the San Francisco Tenants Union and part of the Yes on 10 coalition. So tell us, Deepa, from your perspective, why you think Prop 10 should pass.
We're in the middle of an incredible housing crisis. We've seen it in San Francisco for some years, and it's at this point it's spread around the state, it's spread around the country, but this is really the epicenter. Today, California has the highest poverty rate in the nation once you take the cost of housing into account. And this is something that people all over the state are seeing in their everyday lives. Renters certainly see it in terms of their own bills and their own instability and their own fears. And homeowners see it too in terms of their neighbors, the teachers of their children. I've heard it from healthcare professionals in terms of their patients choosing between taking medications versus paying their rent and seeing their health decline. We see it in terms of businesses not being able to hire employees, particularly service workers. So it's impacting, it's having ripple impacts for higher and higher income brackets and for more and more industries and more communities. The time to do something is yesterday, to be honest, but at the very least we can do it now to try to actually take control back, regain these options in our cities to address this crisis and to come up with solutions that work for us locally.
So, as we mentioned in the intro, Costa-Hawkins, if it's repealed, if Prop 10 passes, would eliminate restrictions on cities' abilities to enact rent control laws and policies or to change rent control laws that have been frozen in time since the passage of Costa-Hawkins in 95. How do you see this loosening of control on the city's ability to make its own decisions? How do you see that helping to make housing more affordable?
Well, for example, a lot of cities have rent control laws or are attempting to pass rent control laws, but they just can't protect enough units. We see, for example, in San Francisco, there's neighborhoods where a majority of the housing is single-family homes. And even though many, many people living in those units are groups of folks, families, our renters, our students, they aren't protected because of this arbitrary distinction, because of this political choice that was made in 1995 in Sacramento. We used to have rent control on single-family homes in San Francisco, and it was taken away by Costa-Hawkins. And so the neighborhoods that have been really impacted by that are neighborhoods like the Bayview, neighborhoods like the Excelsior. I was speaking with a woman today who is a family, three generations, who live in a home, immigrant family with children, a newborn baby, a grandmother who's disabled. And their rent has been, they got a $1,000 rent increase and an eviction notice, and they expect to get court documents any day. And they have no defense in that case. And the city can do nothing to protect them because that right was taken away by Costa-Hawkins. It has real, real impacts. And without Costa-Hawkins, if that was repealed and we were able to reenact those rules, this family would have been able to stay and would be able to go on about their life and stay here in the city. That's just one example, but we see examples every day at the Tenants Union and in other community organizations all over the city and all over the state.
And how about what would you want the city to do? You mentioned one thing there, which is to place single-family homes under rent control. But what would you like to see San Francisco do should Prop 10 pass and Costa-Hawkins be repealed?
Well, certainly it's time to update the law in terms of newer buildings that are constructed. 1979, again, is an arbitrary date for when we passed rent control here in San Francisco. And Costa-Hawkins didn't just freeze in time our ability to pass rent control at the time of Costa-Hawkins. It actually punished cities that already had passed rent control. Cities like San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland, and LA and retroactively said that we can't protect any units that have been built since 1979. At this point, that is nearly 40 years ago. We're not talking about new construction anymore. We're talking about units that have been financed, have been paid for, that there's no reason that those units shouldn't be protected now and that those tenants shouldn't have some stability in their lives and in their budgets. So that law needs to be updated. Of course, it needs to be updated in a way that new construction can continue to happen and isn't impacted. But honestly, we have to... Developers are up in arms about how they believe that all housing will stop if rent control, if Costa-Hawkins is repealed. And that's, we simply don't believe that that's true, because we can pass a rolling law such as what Berkeley has come into, has proposed. There's a few cities that have put forth their thoughts on what they want to pass if Costa-Hawkins is repealed. And in Berkeley, they came up with a 20-year rolling date. Basically, a building will be built after 20 years. Those units will automatically fall under rent control, so we don't have to wait until the next crisis before we update the year again. I think something like that makes a lot of sense for buildings being built going forward. I think anything already built is not going to be impacted in terms of whether it's built or not. It already exists, of course. But I think we can come up with a fair compromise if we are allowed to even have the conversation. And what Costa-Hawkins does is it prevents us from having that conversation here in the city.
All right. So that was Deepa Varma, who is part executive director of the San Francisco Tenants Union and part of the Yes on 10 coalition. I'm going to give you now, Matt Reagan, the senior vice president of the Bay Area Council, part of the No on 10 campaign, the chance to respond to Deepa. And specifically, why don't you think that cities should have the ability to control the rents of the people who live there? Why should it be something that is in the state's in the state's bailiwick?
Well, let me begin by saying, you know, I agree with Deepa 100% that we are in the midst of a housing crisis of unprecedented proportions, and it is driving our poverty rate to the highest in the nation when families' rents or house payments are factored in. That housing crisis, that affordability crisis, that crisis of poverty is driven by our inability to build homes. We are at a generational low in terms of new housing starts. If you go back to 1955, between 1955 and the early 1990s, we averaged in California over 200,000 units of new housing a year. In the last 6 years, we've averaged 80,000. We stopped building homes in the early 2000s, and we've never started again. There's a multitude of reasons for that, but primarily the housing crisis is driven by a lack of supply. We firmly believe that Prop 10, should it pass, will exacerbate that problem. Connor mentioned the economists are all but united in their opinion that rent control being applied to new construction will stifle new construction. And that's absolutely the last thing we need when we're in this dearth of supply. You know, I spoke with one of our members, a lender in the South Bay, just a few weeks ago, who was working on an apartment project, an apartment deal in San Jose. They pulled the plug on that apartment project because the developer couldn't guarantee the rental income on that project with the specter of Prop 10 looming. And they told the lender told the developer, come back to us in November after the election and we'll talk. So it hasn't even passed yet, and it's killing housing. So we at the Bay Area Council, we pride ourselves on being data-driven, not dogma-driven. And the data is clear and unequivocal, unimpeachable. Rent control stops new housing construction. It actually does more than that. When rent control is applied, you know, as Connor correctly pointed out, it creates winners and losers. The winners are existing tenants who hit the jackpot and get the rent-controlled apartment in the lottery. But what it also does is it discourages landlords from maintaining their properties. So the overall quality of the housing stock goes down. And then you get a lot of landlords, particularly the smaller family mom-and-pop landlords who may have a few units as their retirement income. They're much more likely, and the data is clear again on this, to take those units off the market and sell them. A small mom-and-pop landlord does not want the rent board coming visiting. They'd much rather not deal with that level of government when they're with their tenants. So you get less rental stock overall. The beneficiaries of that are the people who can afford to buy. So it's the people at the bottom of the income ladder who suffer most when particularly strict rent controls are passed. And that's, I think, not what we're trying to achieve here. I think Deepa and I are united in our intentions and our goals to help solve this housing crisis and this affordability crisis. I think we just disagree that Prop 10's the solution to the problem. I think it's a medicine that could kill the patient.
So, first of all, we don't really know what would happen after day one. So it's interesting if Proposition 10 passed. It's interesting to hear how people might, in this anecdote you shared, might already be responding to it as if it had already passed. Tell us more about how landlords look at or developers look at a project. Does rent control is it just a no-go as you describe it, or does it give people a chance to kind of know what they can expect, since rent control tells them kind of what they can and cannot do when they set and rents and how they can raise rents? Wouldn't that give developers some sense of what they could reap from their investment?
Developing properties and housing is an incredibly risky undertaking and venture. On the front end, a developer has to negotiate with a property owner for the value of the land to purchase the land. Then they have to run the gauntlet of getting the project approved through multiple local flaming hoops. They have to then negotiate with labor, they have to negotiate with suppliers, they have to pay all of their contractors. And as the project moves through the process, quite often get sued. They then have to negotiate with community groups for community benefits agreements, impact fees. And at each step in the process, value is taken out of the project. And what's left at the end of the day is what the developer takes as their cut. They're the last person to eat at the table, if you will. If then the government says, we're going to impose on the front end all of these incredibly high risky costs, and on the back end we're going to cap any potential profits you can make on the deal, investors are going to go elsewhere with their money. Investors always look for the highest return on their dollar, and this is just how Wall Street works. They look for the highest return on the dollar, and if you say we're capping potential profits on rental housing, they will build condos, or they will buy Bitcoin, or they will invest in Tesla. They will do something other than build rental housing. And I think, again, that's not what we need at this time in our history.
One more question before I let Deepa respond. What about Deepa's proposal that rent control wouldn't necessarily apply to all new construction as soon as it's constructed? It could be phased in over a number of years, say 20 years, the way Berkeley is proposing. Wouldn't that be a way to kind of mitigate some of this chilling effect on development?
Well, that's making the assumption that cities won't use rent control as just another tool to stop housing construction. If you look at our regional housing needs allocation numbers in the Bay Area for the past several cycles, the vast majority of our cities have failed to meet those numbers. I spend way too many late evenings at planning commission meetings and have done for over a decade. I'm a housing advocate. I go to city halls across the region and fight for more housing. And I see local electeds, some of them trying to do the right thing, many of them trying to do the right thing, but they are faced with incredible pressures by NIMBY groups to stop the construction of new housing. They have zoning controls at their disposal to stop new housing. If you give them pricing controls on top of zoning controls, that's a huge multiplier. You can stop a project by saying, no, you're not allowed to build that type of project here, or you can stop a project by saying you can only charge X number of dollars, knowing that the project will never pencil. So saying that we can, cities are free to impose a rolling rent control that'll be good for the developers, that's assuming that cities actually want the housing. And I think that's a big assumption to make, particularly when you look at the track record of a lot of our cities in terms of housing production.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're diving into the pros and cons of the argument for and against the Proposition 10. That would be the repeal of the Costa-Hawkins Act that was passed in 1995 that put some restrictions on rent control in the state of California. We heard at the beginning of our program from Connor Doherty with the New York Times, just now Matt Regan, the senior vice president of the Bay Area Council, who opposes Prop 10, and Deepa Varma is also joining us, the executive director of the SF Tenants Union and part of the Yes on 10 coalition. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Should the ability to regulate rents be returned back to local government, and is rent control the right way to tackle the affordable housing crisis that we're currently in? It seems like both sides agree on. How will you be voting on Prop 10? We invite you to join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Deepa Varma, back to you here. Matt was just talking, he says that the real problem is there's not enough housing, and that lifting restrictions on rent control will only exacerbate the problem. How do you respond to that?
I think that's absolutely not true for several reasons. First of all, it's never happened that any rent-controlled city in the nation has placed limits on buildings that are brand new. They've all had some sort of protections and whatever. I'm not going to call it protections. They've all allowed landlords to set and developers to set rents when they first construct a building. And to be honest, and rent control cities have built more housing and have built faster than non-rent controlled cities in California. In LA and in San Francisco and in Berkeley, for example, they all built in LA it was 136%. They built more housing than neighboring areas that were not rent-controlled. In San Francisco, it was over 30%. So the idea that this would freeze housing is scare tactics in order to preserve profits and nothing more. So this conversation about developers currently stopping projects, not building them right now, has to do with the fact that we're talking about potential instability in terms of what might happen, and they're waiting to see how things fall out. But when we talk about winners and losers, we should think about the people who are really being harmed right now, who are the people who aren't sure if they're going to have a roof over their head next month. This is a reality for Californians right now. More and more homeless families, more and more people working more and more jobs, deciding between food and rent, deciding between medications and rent, moving farther and farther away from their jobs, driving 2 and 3 hours to get to jobs in places in the Bay Area, for example. The losers in the current state of affairs are low-income and middle-income people. And the winners are of an unregulated market are the businesses that benefit from having no regulations on them. And, of course, they are fighting regulations. That always happens. In terms of the conversation around mom-and-pop landlords selling, right now there's a huge speculative market to buy up property from mom-and-pop landlords. And more of those units are going into the hands of large-scale corporate owners. For example, and those same companies are the biggest donors to the No on 10 campaign. Companies like Blackstone, Essex Properties, Equity Residential. These are the companies that they're some of the biggest landlords in the entire country, and much of their portfolio is single-family homes that they bought after the foreclosure crisis. And they are spending millions and millions of dollars to make sure that their portfolios won't be regulated. And those are the winners those are the winners of not regulating. And the losers are everyday people who are trying to just make ends meet.
So going back to Connor Doherty's point in the beginning of the show from the New York Times, who said that, and I won't speak for you completely, Connor, so you can chime in here in a second, but the point being that if rent control is liberalized, that there's the immediate gains of making housing more affordable in the short term, but not in the long term. And you're not buying that premise.
I think that we're going to have to figure out, I mean, if we win this and we manage to get vacancy control, for example, we haven't even talked about vacancy control, which I think is a critical point in San Francisco. The longer a tenant's in their home, the bigger a target they feel on their back, because a bigger bonus a landlord can get by evicting them. And that's just the wrong incentive structure. But the studies show that tenants, especially long-term tenants, get the biggest gains from rent control. And I don't think that's a bad thing. We should encourage in a society that people put down roots and that they become stable members of their community and that they build networks and they support each other. That's not a bad thing. And in San Francisco, it's meant that places like San Francisco and New York that have had rent control for a long time are places where renters vote and they have civic engagement and they are really active members of their community, whereas in other places, renters can't have that kind of stability and community engagement. In terms of new people who haven't moved in yet, I mean, and it's also that there's a huge difference to somebody in someone's life in terms of disrupting someone's life in terms of moving into a place versus uprooting a family, uprooting a senior on a fixed income, where they might not be able to regain those networks. That said, it is important for new people to be able to live places as well. We're not against building housing. But to be honest, it's not just a matter of building more luxury housing and hoping that supply trickles down. Right now, there's more empty units in San Francisco than there are homeless people. That's because there's a distribution problem here as well of income. And it's not just a question of more units trickling down to the poor and working class.
Okay, so back to you, Matt Reagan. What do you make of Adipa's comments that this is really about protecting, being no on 10 is about protecting profits, and that in fact there is what's being built is currently is really tilted towards the luxury market, and that there's also a lot of unutilized property out there, and that we have to take these things into consideration when we're looking at the issues of poverty and affordable housing.
I'd just like to maybe comment on a few data points that Deepa made about San Francisco and Berkeley in particular, and they're probably our two largest cities with rent control and their performance as it relates to housing construction. Start with Berkeley. The population of Berkeley in 1950 was 112,000. The population of Berkeley in 2010 was 112,000. In that interim period, the population of California quadrupled. So rent-controlled Berkeley took on zero of the new residents of California in that period of time. So I would argue that rent control did not work in Berkeley. In San Francisco, in the last RENA cycle, for low-income units, San Francisco met 27% of its RENA obligation.
What's the RENA obligation?
Regional housing needs allocation. So the state determines what the future housing need of California is going to be, and it's carved up among all the cities and the metropolitan planning regions in the state. And each city gets a number, and they're over a seven-year cycle, they're expected to permit that number of units to meet natural population growth. In the moderate income sector, San Francisco met 18%. Of its units. So I would argue that they're not success stories.
And just for a moment here, what's correlation versus causation here? How are you linking those two things, as the fact that cities have not met their housing requirements, and you're linking that to rent control? Can you make that point for us?
Well, what I'm doing is challenging the assertion that Deepa made, that cities that have rent control are outperforming and they're doing a great job at building housing. The data says otherwise. None of our cities are building enough housing.
And can you point to rent control as the cause for that?
It's one of the many causes, certainly as it relates. Well, we don't have rent control in new construction, so I can't say that it's stopping new construction. But it's certainly what I would say is that it's a distortion on the market that doesn't have a positive effect. to what degree, I don't know. But if you look at, I mean, the Bay Area Council Economic Institute did a study earlier this year on the impacts of rent control for Alameda County, and that study concluded that if rent control was passed county-wide, it would mean that 10,300 families currently living in Alameda would no longer be able to afford to live in Alameda County. And one of the peer cities that they analyzed was Ontario, Canada, where they instituted a very strict form of rent control in 1975. And that study was a longitudinal study looking at the 12 years before rent control went into effect and the 12 years after. In that period, new home construction fell by 46% after the imposition of the strict form of rent control. So, you know, the economists are clear, as Connor said in his opening comments. The country's economists are more united in their opinion about rent control being bad for affordability than climatologists are that humans are causing climate change. But somehow it's okay to ignore the economists, the experts on rent control, but you know, you're a knuckle dragger if you ignore the climatologists on climate change. So, I mean, I would argue you have to look at the experts, you have to look at the data, you have to look at the science, and to say that it's not going to have an effect or it's not going to have an adverse impact on affordability is just denying the facts and the data.
Connor, since your comments were referenced twice, I want to make sure you get a chance to make some comments here.
Well, I said at the top of the hour, and I'll say again, this is sort of a choice for a lot of people. Well, let me put it this way. There's almost no one who knows much about this who would argue that this isn't a large supply problem in California. On the other hand, there's nobody living on the ground today who wouldn't say renters are having a really hard time right now, and that it would be, and that there's a great desire to help them now. So this is the pickle we've gotten ourselves into, a long-term problem that is not going to be fixed soon, and a short-term problem that people walking around seeing homelessness and whatnot have a great hunger to fix. So here we are. And I think a lot of people, whatever they think about economist studies, do want to do something to help renters today. And the question is Prop 10, you know, the best way to do that? I'm not here to sort of make that decision for people, but I will say if you broaden the subject more widely, and you ask, you know, do people, what do experts, or experts is probably a bad idea, what do people who are thinking about this pragmatically right now, even people who are against Prop 10, think about the concept of helping renters today? So Berkeley had a big study where they talk about an anti-gouging rent cap, something that would, you know, hold rents at something like 10% a year, at the very, very max, and would apply to all homes in the state. We don't need to, like, discuss that proposal, but my point is that's something that a lot of people who might not, like, be for Prop 10 are talking about. It's something that if Prop 10 failed, I would actually expect to see be introduced to the legislature next year. Whether or not it would go anywhere is, you know, another matter. So I think that when we, while experts are good, and I certainly, you know, checked some experts at the beginning, you know, just so that people can understand things, we do have this problem right now, and we do generally seem to, in California, want to help people who are struggling very mightily right now. And the question is, what's the best way to do that, and what type of activity do we want to, you know, prevent? You know, there's a very common story, and I can tell you I've experienced it quite a lot on the ground. It happens a good deal more on the peninsula than in San Francisco, of a landlord who goes and buys, or sorry, an investor who goes and buys a new apartment complex that is, or sorry, a very old, gross apartment complex that isn't particularly nice. And then they clear everyone out, and then they raise the rent $1,000, and maybe if you're lucky, they paint it. And a lot of people don't like that activity. In fact, even economists don't like that activity. They say that the only use of that activity is, quote, price discovery, which is quite a way of putting it. So there's a lot of ideas for wanting to help renters now, and Prop 10 is one of those ideas. It's not a there are fairly conservative people who, when they're feeling about, you know, societal fabric and whatever else, want to impose some kind of price cap temporarily or whatever, who don't think, what I'm saying is, who don't think the idea of capping rents is a horrible idea, but they don't think Prop 10 is a good way of doing it. So I guess I just try to keep in perspective what, without like going back and forth about like this study this, this study that, I think that it's important to keep in perspective that we do have two problems in California. One is a long-term problem that we don't want to make any worse, but the other is a short-term problem that we seem to want to do something about. And, you know, anytime you have a mix of problems like that, you end up doing, you know, picking kind of bittersweet options, you know, meaning sometimes you pick some degree of, like a price, like I said, like a price cap of 10% or something like that. So I just kind of want to try to say that there are even people who are, you know, economists or who would be against Prop 10, who would be for some kind of price cap of some kind. And, you know, anyway, I just think it's important to kind of keep in perspective that we do have a reality on the ground that is a little bit more complicated than studies make it out to be.
So I want to make sure to get our guests back in the studio back into the conversation. But thanks for that, Connor. And want to make sure to put the phone number out again if you want to join our conversation tonight about Prop 10, which is about repealing Costa-Hawkins, which would liberalize rent control in cities across California, should it pass, potentially would decrease restrictions on rent control across California. What actually happens remains to be seen. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. Let's actually go to a caller, Anna from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm calling because I was looking at information regarding Prop 10 and I didn't find an answer for it, and that is regarding owner move-ins, because I'm a public school teacher. My husband was a public school teacher and he worked 3 part-time jobs, so we bought some houses that he and my sons and I worked on to fix up to rent, and we specifically looked for families. We put out, and we have teachers living in some houses, but we also have grandchildren now, and as our children get older, you know, they may want to move in. So I want, from what I understand, it would be almost prohibitively expensive, if not impossible, to do an owner move-in down the line, but I may be wrong. So that's my concern, because we deliberately went out, and we didn't buy foreclosures. We just worked hard, you know, weekends for years, fixing up houses. And we have 2 in San Francisco and 1 in Oakland. And we rent to teachers and families specifically without gouging. But if it were true that we, you know, we've never been able to pass those on to our children or our grandchildren, we might sell early. So I just wanted to hear someone's response.
Thanks so much, Anna, for your call.
Yeah, thanks.
Go ahead.
I can answer that question. Prop 10 has nothing to do with the owner move-in laws in San Francisco or anywhere in the state. It simply has to do with rent control. It would have no impact on your decision or your choice to move it yourself or a family member into a unit that you own.
All right. So this issue of what happens when a renter leaves. So vacancy control, which is kind of a hard concept to get your head around. But my understanding, if I get it right, is with Costa Hawkins in place now, vacancy control is prohibited, which means that a landlord can raise the rent to the market rate once a tenant moves out. If Prop 10 passes and Costa Hawkins is repealed, that restriction would be removed, and theoretically it would take cities some doing to actually allow to prohibit landlords to raise rents to the market rate. It wouldn't just happen on the day after the election. Why, Deepa, is this such an important piece of this proposition?
It's so important because we talked about how expensive it is to move into a new unit today and how every unit goes back to market rate. I talked to a tenant today in my office who moved into his unit. He's a trans man in San Francisco, moved into his unit 20 years ago with his partner. His partner passed away a few months ago. And his partner was the tenant, original tenant on the lease, and he moved in with the permission of the landlord, but he was not the original occupant. At that point, the landlord raised the rent 7 times what it had originally been. And he came to the tenants' union on the same day that he went to the crematorium for his partner. And we had to give him the bad news that we don't have the ability to that rent increase is legal and there's nothing we can do.
Because he's not on the lease.
Because he is not the original occupant. The language is, okay, in Costa Hawkins is about the original occupant.
Okay.
In New York, tenants have that kind of protection. Family members, household members who have that kind of protection if they've been in a unit for more than 2 years and if they've lived with that family member for some time. And we see this kind of heartbreaking story every week. That's the most extreme example. But, of course, there's also the examples of any situation in which a tenant is in their place for a long time. As their rent is lower and lower than market, there's more and more pressure to push that tenant out. And that is just the wrong incentive. It's a policy that creates these perverse scenario in which landlords take worse and worse care of they treat longer term tenants worse and worse. Longer term tenants are more and more afraid to speak up about their rights, and landlords target them for harassment. We've seen that in particular with one of the big corporate owners in San Francisco, that's now the biggest owner, the biggest landlord in San Francisco with over 10,000 units in their portfolio, which is Veritas. They will buy a building. They will pass through a number of costs, which pass-throughs, of course, are fine. If a landlord has costs that exceed what their if they make a bunch of repairs and alterations to a building, be it improvements, they should be able to pass those costs through. But they do that, and then they pass the cost only on to the longest-term tenants with the hope that some of those tenants leave or will not be able to afford those costs, and then they can flip a certain number of units. In their loan documents, they actually demonstrate that they expect a certain amount of turnover and going to market rate, and then they borrow money to they finance the purchase of these buildings with the intent of flipping a certain number of units, which means in real terms, it means people losing their homes, people losing that stability in their lives, people being put in this economy, people being pushed out of the city.
So Matt, wanted to have you, you're not here necessarily representing landlords, but this idea of Costa Hawkins creating these perverse incentives that then lead to situations where rents get jacked up on long-term tenants who, by a technicality, that could still happen, as properties change hands, new people come in with the intent to really move some long-term tenants out so that they can raise the rent because vacancy controls are prohibited. How do you respond to that?
I do agree with you 100% that market controls, price controls, any kind of distortions do create perverse incentives. And the analogy I like to use is, a generation ago, we passed Prop 13 in California, and people who are on the wrong side of the ledger of Prop 13 have called that generational wealth theft. A generation ago, people voted to cap their property taxes and pass the costs on to future generations. And we've seen what has happened to California, its education budget, and other things since then. This is an analogous situation where you cap rents for existing tenants, and you cut the supply off for future tenants, and they will fight for fewer and fewer units and be victims of a much tighter housing market and have far fewer opportunities going forward. So I definitely agree that that's a real scenario and something to be very worried about. To Deepa's point about landlords behaving badly, when you have a shortage, when you have a huge demand for such a few number of units, you encourage bad behavior. The only real power tenants have is choice. The choice to be able to tell a bad landlord, I'm not going to live here anymore. I'm going to move and get another unit down the street. We don't give tenants that choice because we don't build enough housing units. If a landlord refuses to fix the roof, if a landlord is unreasonably raising the rent, if a landlord is being anyway abusive, harassing, tenants have no choice because we don't build enough housing. If we only built enough housing and gave tenants choice, we would give them the power. All the power that Deepa wants to give tenants, we could give them. If we allowed developers to build homes and rent them to tenants, but we don't allow that to happen. We as a society in California, and our situation is a reflection of our values. We value too many other things over affordable housing. And we don't build housing, and we don't give tenants any choice.
So again, Deepa, this is a chance for you to respond. How is our rent controls or putting caps on how much rents can be raised once a tenant moves out? How does that go against affordable housing in your mind, or does it?
So
First of all,
I disagree. I disagree that shortages are what creates bad behavior. I think an imbalance of power is what creates bad behavior. The worst landlords are the landlords who in places that don't have rent control. Those are places where tenants are afraid to ask for repairs altogether. That's places like the Central Valley, where tenants live in. I mean, the situation is it's low income tenants. Landlords don't make repairs for low income tenants anywhere unless tenants have the power to force them to. And they only have that when they have protections. They only have that in cities like San Francisco, LA, and so forth. In other places, they know that they can be retaliated against and just pushed out by standing up for themselves. And I've seen that as a tenant attorney myself in terms of the tenants who have those protections and the tenants who don't.
So the question here is, Matt's point again is that, in fact, what you're trying to achieve is going to lead to more affordable housing crunch down the road, and that's just kicking the can down the road to help relieve people in the short term.
We need to relieve people in the short term. And honestly, this is a crisis at a scale we haven't seen since our organization has been around for the last 47 years at this point. This is a crisis of such epic proportions that if we don't resolve it now, I don't even know what we're going to do. We're seeing tent cities, we're seeing people with multiple jobs still unable to afford a single place to live. And it's also the case that there's nowhere in the country where a minimum wage person has the choice to just move to another unit because there's other supply somewhere else. It's worse in California and it's worse in San Francisco, but there's not a single city in the entire country, whether there's rent control or not, where a tenant can afford a market rate unit who has a minimum wage job that they work full time. So we're seeing a situation where without some decisions by government and decisions by our society to protect folks and to make sure that they get their needs met, we're not going to see those needs getting met.
Let's go to one or two callers in before the end of the hour. Let's start with Garrett from Oakland. Garrett, welcome to the program.
Hi. One of your speakers there mentioned that we have a problem with getting enough housing, and I believe we have a real problem that politicians would rather have issues like rent control to get elected on rather than fixing up the zoning and the building permit process, which is a horrible disaster, especially in Oakland. I'm a landlord. I'm also a landlord attorney. And I will tell you that it cost me $40,000 in permits just to put in one single little apartment under an existing house, whereas in Newark, it only cost $4,000. That's why rent is so expensive in Oakland, because my house in Oakland has tripled in value. My rents haven't even doubled in the last 20 years. Right. Now, the other thing is zoning. I tried to build a 16-unit apartment house one block from West Oakland BART, the best BART station ever, because all the trains go through it. The city wouldn't let me do it because they said only 2 units per parcel, even though in 1888 it had 8 units on it. 3 of them burned down. They wouldn't let me build them back up. So this is ridiculous zoning, and the only people who can fight it are the experts who are hired by big corporations. And that's why everybody complains about the big corporations, because they do discover and they do know how to get around some of the rent controls. Whereas my little landlords, who usually own 1 to 4 units grand total, pay me almost as much as an attorney to help them write the letter to raise their rents as they're going to get in a year of the increased rents. So a lot of them don't even bother to increase the rents except every 2 years so they can actually save a little bit on attorney's fees, and they're afraid of rent control. Every landlord has to make repairs. Otherwise, any lawyer like myself will take the case on contingency for any tenant and get those repairs made if they affect livability or health. And there's huge rewards for any tenant who has had a landlord that doesn't repair the roof leak, doesn't fix the plumbing. So as far as I know, every landlord except a few, I guess you call them slumlords, try to get away without doing repairs, but it's very rare.
All right, thanks so much.
Even with rent control, we have to do the repairs or we get in big trouble.
All right, thanks so much for your call, Garrett. So Deepa, what do you make of his comment that he's sort of changing the topic here in a certain way and saying it's really not about rent control solving the problem, it's about changing zoning laws?
Zoning laws are not going to get people into housing who live under freeways right now. Zoning laws are not going to keep this person who is losing, who got a rent increase beyond her ability to pay last week, who I expect to see getting evicted in the next month. I'm not taking issue with zoning laws. This has nothing to do with zoning laws. This has to do with tenant protections for tenants who are currently housed and trying to keep the problem from getting worse in terms of the displacement crisis, the homeless crisis, and the fear that tenants are living with all over California right now.
And the second point he made was that it's hard for him to necessarily make repairs sometimes because he can't raise the rents to be able to afford the repairs.
There are protections for landlords in California law right now. Those protections say that a landlord is entitled to a reasonable return on their profits. There's no such protections like that. What that means is a couple of things. Landlords are able to raise rents even in rent-controlled jurisdictions by a small amount. Their own costs tend to be relatively fixed between Prop 13 and mortgage rate, fixed-rate mortgages. And if their costs go beyond what their rent increases allow for, they have options. They are allowed to do pass-throughs in every single rent-controlled jurisdiction in California. And if the pass-throughs are not enough, historically, in cities like Berkeley that had vacancy control, they also were able to petition the rent board for an increase above that. But those petitions almost never happened because landlords generally actually do fine. They actually do manage to make those profits, and they manage to make up the money for repairs. Rents, that's what rent is for, is keeping up your building. We're just talking about some of that reasonability coming to tenants as well, having some reasonable expectation about what 1 month is going to look like compared to the next. It's about keeping it fair and balanced.
All right. We have like less than a minute left, so I want to give you a few seconds each to kind of make your closing pitch for less than a minute. So as I start with you, Deepa, and then you'll get the last word, Matt, since we started with Deepa at the beginning of the hour. What's your pitch to voters on Prop 10?
Prop 10 is simply the chance for cities to decide for themselves how we're going to protect our people and how we're going to keep people housed and solve this crisis that we see at the local level. There's no reason we should be limited at the state level in terms of the kind of protections we have.
And Matt?
Proposition 10, as Deepa said in her opening comments, will do nothing immediately. Cities will have to go through another election process to pass rent controls. In the interim, we could declare a housing state of emergency and build 500,000 more than Prop 10.
And we're going to have to stop it here. Thanks for listening. Thanks to my guests.